This is tape number two, side one. Let's get back to our discussion on KLIF 1190 Dallas.
One of the interesting things they did in the early 60s is an operation that was very secret in the McClendon Corporation. He did this on all of his stations. It was called Operation Matthew. And Operation Matthew was a plan that for a one-week period, and who today would commit that much time to this, for a one-week period, this was in 1962 when relations with Moscow were very, very tenuous at best. He put on Radio Moscow from shortwave radio instead of his local newscast every hour for the five-minute newscast that they fed out. He did not tell anybody other than the White House about this. He did not inform the FCC because he was afraid they would tell him not to do it. McClendon was famous throughout the entire years for his many, many battles with the FCC. This was one of them. They were very unhappy with this after it happened, but were not able to stop it because he had already started it. Never pre-promoted it, just the day it was to begin, he preempted every newscast on the radio station with a statement saying, instead of the regular news, you're going to hear Radio Moscow. The reaction was immediate and unbelievable from listeners and the advertising crowd and broadcasters in general, because it was just so unusual to hear the other side of what was going on. We were always hearing our side of the situation between the two countries, which, as you all recall, was very, very tenuous at the time. In Cliff News, they always kept a Rolodex in the studio for the newsman on duty to have handy. And in this Rolodex was the list of all kinds of specialists from every imaginable field you could think of. If cotton prices, for instance, went up dramatically or something happened in that regard, they would have the president of the local cotton producers association, and the newsman could call him and say, how does this reflect on anything that may happen in this part of the country or in our city? And they would have an actuality from him and say, well, that's going to affect us because farmers here are blah, 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 you know, whatever the case may be. They would have a psychologist who could comment on the sniper in Austin. You know, it would just be a way to take a national story and make it local. So the Rolodex at Cliff was used for this purpose. The crisscross directories in Dallas and Fort Worth were used in this way, all the other cities around as well. For instance, if a fire occurred, they may not be able to get a mobile news unit out there quickly enough to take a report on it. So they would call the residents or the business across the street and say, look out your window, what are you seeing? All the while, they're rolling tape back at the studio. Well, there's four fire trucks out here. It looks like the flames are shooting through the roof, but I don't think anybody was injured. All the four people that live there are standing out on the front porch. Well, there's your actuality. Who needs a mobile news reporter out there? You've got the neighbor telling you everything you need to know. So the crisscross directory was used extensively for that purpose. If there was an accident, I've got a tape somewhere at home where there's an accident at Central and Mockingbird, just down from Central and Mockingbird, and they didn't have anybody out there, so the newsman called Campese's restaurant and said, have you seen the wreck out front? Tell me about it. And the lady goes, yeah, it's a Corvette and a Ford station wagon. The lady in the station wagon's really banged up bad. There's two ambulances here right now, and the whole street's blocked in both directions. Again, boom, they've got their actuality. The story is covered. And they didn't even commit any of their own resources to it. They used the public. Some famous names in news worked at KLIF. Malcolm Landis, a man who contacted me just this week, former Channel 8 TV anchorman back in the 70s, and also now still in television news, number one man in Denver. Brad Messer, Michael Hyatt, Robert A. Knowlton, Bruce Hughes, Ted Agnew, Phil Allen, Alan Cole, Bill Grady, Joe Halstead, Bob Richmond, Ron McAllister, Bob Morrison. The names go on and on and on. One of the things that was sort of a part of news at KLIF, too, were the infamous Gordon McClendon editorials. And Gordon started this idea mainly because he had things he wanted to say, and he wanted a forum to be able to do that. And so they would create, he would write and produce these Cliff editorials. And what these were Gordon's personal views on matters of whatever importance he had felt needed to be addressed that day. He may be talking about Radio Moscow. He may be talking about the administration or a member of it. Or he might be talking about something going on in the city government or something like that. So they would air these editorials four or five times during the course of a day and offer equal time to anybody who would like to comment and rebut his editorials. Often they would go unchallenged. But McClendon's editorials were recorded in Dallas at the corporate headquarters on Jackson Street and played on all the McClendon stations across the United States. Cliff was huge in sports because of his love of sports early in the Liberty Broadcasting Network. When the Dallas Cowboys began, his friendship with Clint Murchison, the original owner, enabled them to get the Cowboys on KLIF, and they were on there through the end of the 1971 season, throughout the entire 60s, and just a little bit into the early 70s. When they won their first Super Bowl, that was the last broadcast of the Dallas Cowboys on KLIF. That was also at the time when KLIF was sold. Sales machine, KLIF was definitely it. They aired 18 minutes, maximum number of commercials every hour, almost every hour. Huge, huge rates for the time. Back in the 60s, they were getting like $100 a spot.
Wow.
Huge rates for back then, but they were claiming, in some cases, 30 to 60% of the audience. Overall, throughout the 60s, they had averaged 30 shares. Imagine what a station in Dallas-Fort Worth with a 30 share could do today. Everybody's scrapping for 5 shares now. At night, Russ Knight, the Weird Beard, at one time had a 60 share. When Gordon McClendon would buy a radio station, he would give away his advertising for the first 30 days. Every radio station he purchased, he would give away all advertising. Anybody wanted to advertise, until he ran out of inventory, he would give it away. He felt this was the best way to advertise his own radio station. Come, tell me whatever spot you want. We'll cut it, we'll produce it, we'll put it on the air as many times as you want. And he would give it away. You know, they would see real quick that it would work for him. I mentioned earlier his promotional ideas and his expertise in that area. Three famous rules of Gordon McClendon promotion and carried out extensively at KLIF. Talk about it, do it, tell them what you did. There was no promotion ever done on that radio station where they didn't talk about it, pre-promote it, and pre-promote it to death. Most of the time, the actual performance of whatever it was they were going to do, if it were an event or a contest, would often not be as grandiose as the promo that promoted it. But he wanted it to sound that way, bigger than life. Then, whereas most radio stations would possibly pre-promote an idea and do it when the contest or event ended, that would be the end of it. You wouldn't hear any more about it. Well, he said, let's get more mileage out of it by telling him what we did. So his post-promotion was as important as his pre-promotion. So he would do promos, follow-up promos, for many, many times after. One of the great promotions in the 60s was the Great River Raft. Legendary disc jockey Jimmy Rabbit and Chuck Dunaway. Chuck was a former KLIF disc jockey, was then down at Houston at KILT. And Jimmy was still at KLIF. They took a river race, and interestingly, Chuck Dunaway tells me the story that he cheated and won on that, by the way. Top 40 surveys. Remember Top 40 surveys? Cliff didn't start those. In fact, there's a good reason to believe that KXOL in Fort Worth, when Chuck Dunaway was over there, might have had, and Kent Burkhart might have had something to do with beginning some of those. But KLIF certainly perfected it and took it a step further, featuring song lyrics, photos of the disc jockeys, profiles of their disc jockeys, newsmen, studio shots, promotional tidbits, and they even sold commercials on them. Later on, in the late 60s and early 70s, they did Cliff Classic LPs, where they would take some recent hits, put them on a various artist's album, put disc jockey photos on them, and sell albums at record stores, their own records. Interesting thing about Cliff, we all know wherever we were from, there was a radio station that we all remember. During the 60s, as I said, through most of it, they averaged 30% of the audience. Unbelievable audience. They had some stiff competition for a while from K-Box, which was also a top 40 station at the time. K-Box had an inferior signal to KLIF's 50,000 watts, but during the early 60s gave them a very, very serious run for the money, and in some day parts beat them a time or two. Never was able to beat them completely, and finally in the early part of 1967 they gave up and went country. In the days of non-air-conditioned cars in the Dallas North Central Texas area, it was not uncommon to drive up to a red light and, with your windows rolled down, hear the next car on both sides playing the same song. Cliff was that kind of station. I put in the website that kids loved it, teens dated by it, and adults went to and worked from it. The disc jockeys were teen idols for their time. And one of the more interesting things, too, is that You know, KLIF was a station that not only appealed to the kids, you know, people always call it a rock and roll radio station. When you really go back and listen to tapes of it or look at their surveys and stuff, you realize it wasn't really that much of a rock and roll radio station, you know. They played a lot of country music because country music was popular here. They played easy listening standards from people like Steve Lawrence and Tony Bennett and Sinatra and things like that. You know, it was not uncommon, you know, during the course of an hour to hear, yeah, something by the Beatles and Rolling Stones and Supremes, but something by Glenn Campbell and, you know, Tony Bennett maybe, or Tammy Wynette. It was really a station that appealed to a large, large demographic, and during those times it worked. One of the more interesting things that that McLennan tried to do too in 1967 was clean up the dirty lyrics in songs. And he began a huge campaign, took out a full-page ad in Billboard magazine in 1967, and went on to say, look, we're tired of all these dirty innuendo lyrics in these songs, and from now on, we are not going to play them. And that was a huge statement to the recording and music industry, because KLIF was one of the most influential stations. If you got an ad for a record on KLIF, it parlayed into success oftentimes across the United States. He also went on the Art Linklater show and debated the rock group The Standells. And if a tape existed of that, I would love to see it. Because they had a song at the time called Try It. And most people at the time felt like that it was a drug reference. And in fact, Bud provided me one time a list of all of the songs, some of the songs at one particular time anyway, that KLIF banned from the airwaves, including Respect by Aretha Franklin, Sock It to Me by Mitch Ryder, all kinds of songs that you and I today would just roll our eyes at. But at the time, you know, this was his idea to get anything like that off of the air. After K-Box went country in 1967, Cliff kind of had it all to themselves. And the ratings suggest that, too. Their ratings shot up to like 27 shares. At night, they had a 73 immediately after K-Box went country. They were on fire. They realized, too, that their main competition was coming from not only some country stations, but easy listening. WFAA AM was giving them a little run there at the time. So they decided that they were going to add some easy listening elements to the station. The station was always programmed for adults and kids. It was a very broad-based program radio station.
Was that 73 share, like overall? Was it?
No, teens at night. 73 teens at night. Now, interestingly, they programmed the radio station to appeal to a broad section of the population, and it did. But by 1967, having it all to themselves, they decided to pull it out even further, and really it became what is now more like an adult contemporary radio station. Another innovation they had was talk shows. He put Chuck Boyles on, a lawyer, at night, and did a show called Snake Bite. Promos on the air said the snake pit. Everyone hates him. Maybe you'll hate him, too. Rod Roddy did a talk show for him as well. They did astrological forecasts for the day when that was big in the late 60s, early 70s, with personal assistant to Gordon McLennan, Billy Odom, cutting the voice of Lika Kistner. And Don Keyes voicing the disclaimer that said, astrology is a subject of controversy. Dependence upon forecast must be by individual choice. In the early 70s, Cliff DJ Dave Ambrose did a show called Girl Talk during middays, which is kind of like an Oprah Winfrey-type show today, or Dr. Phil, maybe. They did that. It was quite controversial for its time because they would talk about things like, how do you know when your man's been unfaithful to you? When do you think is the right time to make love to your husband? Where is the strangest place you've ever done it? You know, things that were very controversial at the time. So 1970s roll around, and what happens? Suddenly, Gordon McLennan decides he wants to sell KLIF. Is that possible? Well, in 1967, he had an agreement to sell it, along with KILT in Houston, to Lynn Broadcasting for $15 million. That one did not go through because he finally changed his mind and kept Cliff. He did sell Kilt at the time. He wanted to stay in radio, so he kept Cliff. In 1971, he decided to get rid of it, and he sold it to Fairchild Industries for $10.5 million, the single largest price ever paid for a standalone AM radio station at the time. $10.5 million in cash. He moved all of his efforts over to the FM and made KNUS a top 40 radio station, and actually began competing with his old radio station, Cliff. Interestingly, Just in case you're wondering, Mr. McLennan took his $10.5 million that he made from KLIF sale and put it in gold. In 1972, that was selling for $40 an ounce. He sold it in the early 1980s when it was selling for $400 an ounce. So you tell me if he made the right decision. Cliff, under Fairchild Industries, an aviation company that had no prior broadcast experience, was, as Michael O'Shea, the program director, said at the time, a catastrophe. They took a great, great radio station and brought it right to its knees. Fairchild attempted to also purchase 102.9 to make it an FM go along with it. For some reason, the sale did not go through, so they remained with the 1190 frequency for years. One of the biggest things that happened right away was the Dallas Cowboys moved to KRLD. Cliff didn't want to pay the big fee that it cost to have the rights to the radio station, so they let it go. This was right after they won the Super Bowl, obviously an interesting decision as well. One of the biggest decisions came, one of the bigger factors in the market came the following year, 1973, when Arbitron took the markets and combined them. Prior to that, Dallas and Fort Worth were two separate Arbitron markets. Dallas competed with Dallas radio stations, Fort Worth competed with Fort Worth radio stations. Made it a little bit dynamic, and they were able to compete rather well in that arena. When they combined the two markets, then you had to compete with Dallas and Fort Worth radio stations. So in the situation before, maybe you had 15 competitors, now you have 30, 35. Fairchild Industries had already sunk millions in their investment, and just at the time when they needed to reinvest more money to appeal to a broader section of the audience, they did not. Their $10 million slowly dwindled, and as you may know, the ratings for the radio station did. In 1972, when McLendon sold the radio station, it had a 19.8 share. By April, May of 1974, some 3 years later, it had a 5 share. The ratings were dwindling fast. The audience was gone. There were some interesting people that worked at Cliff over the years. Ron Chapman was one of the bigger stars of the radio station, still on the market in the on the air in the market. Original pairing with Tom Murphy on Murphy and Harrigan. And then with Jack Woods as Charlie and Harrigan, Dan McCurdy took over. And then later on, Ron left and went to Channel 8, and then years later to KVIL, and now is still on the air at K-Love. In the early 60s, Ron was number one with Charlie and Harrigan on the market. In the mid-60s, they replaced Charlie and Harrigan with Ken Dow. Ken had been the afternoon drive disc jockey and did a character voice of a grandmother, Granny Emma. And McLendon saw the opportunity to have his two-man show and just pay for one man. Ken and Granny actually bested the Charlie and Harrigan numbers through the years. Other people who went through the morning show, Dino Day, Don Wade, Rod Roddy, Michael O'Shea, Paxton Mills, Dave Ambrose, at one time or another, all were on the Cliff morning show. The list of disc jockeys that worked at Cliff over the years is just amazing. Some of the big names that went on to bigger and better things. Jim O'Brien, a staple in Philadelphia for years, tragically died back in the 80s. Dick Heatherton, Don McGregor, Mike Scott, a big programmer out at KHJ for years. Lee Douglas in New York was big. Brant Miller, still on the air in Chicago television. Rick Shaw passed away a few years ago, was big in Houston and San Francisco. Chuck Dunaway had a huge career in many, many stations. Russ Knight, the Weird Beard, of course, was huge in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Hal Martin, still in broadcasting across the area. Jim Tabor, just looking at some of these names, it's just amazing to think of who worked at that radio station. But it's interesting because many of the people that work there, every time I get an email from one of these people, they say the same thing. Man, KLIF made my career, made my career. Nobody ever made much money there, as the story goes. Michael O'Shea tells me that when he left there as program director and morning man, he's making $18,000 a year, and this was in 1972. You know, still not a lot of money even back then, but he said, the education I received from working at KLIF and for Gordon McLendon has paid for million times over for me. And I think that's interesting and a tribute to the radio station and the legend of Gordon McLendon that, you know, he created such an enormously popular radio station for this market, such an influential radio station across the United States, and the legacy of it continues today, not only in people who've just made a fortune in the broadcast industries, all as a result of what they learned there, but people that continue in the broadcasting industry today that we can listen to each and every day in other parts. Anybody got any questions? Yes, sir.
Yes.
Mike.
Okay. a few of them. Number one, what did KLIF do when Kennedy died?
Interesting question. The JFK assassination was a pivotal point of KLIF and their news department. I only recently acquired the actual logger tapes from KLIF from that day. I have from 11:30 in the morning till 10:30 at night, and then every break that they did live over the entire weekend. And I offered, though, some of the first hour of that is on realradio.com, and some of you may have heard some of that. Just amazing audio from the station that had the biggest audience in Dallas where it happened at the time. But the tapes that I have that go beyond that are equally as interesting. I offered them to the current 570 KLIF, and they declined to air them this year for the 40th anniversary, but I have news. Realradio.com, I just mailed them to them this week, is going to play them in real time on the 40th anniversary this year. And you will be able to listen beginning at 11:30 in the morning until 10:30 at night and hear them as it aired in their entirety without any interruption, no editing. And they will then repeat it through the course of the weekend. One of the more interesting things we're going to do as well is the week prior to that weekend, because this year, the 22nd is on a Saturday. The weekend prior to that, Real Radio is going to run an interview that I'm putting on there where I talk to Gary DeLon and Ken Dow and Roy Nichols and some of the other people who were involved in the coverage that are still alive. And I think that will be an interesting pre-promote to it and kind of a behind-the-scenes look at what was going on in the newsroom when that happened.
What's Ken Elliott doing now?
Ken Elliott, I don't know. Ken Elliott was a newsman in the early 60s at KLIF. Later ended up out in Shreveport, and I do not know from that point where Ken Elliott went. Yes, sir.
You mentioned Bill Stewart.
Yep.
I don't know if you worked with WQAM in Miami, and Tom Stewart took it over in September 56, and I thought that it was Bill Stewart who came down to Omaha to oversee the transition.
Could have been. Very well could have been. I do not know particularly if that was the same Bill Stewart. But it very well might have been. I know he lent his services to many stations. He was national PD of McClendon Corporation during his time. In fact, he worked there two or three different times in the early years, and he came back in the 60s, too. But he was definitely instrumental, not only in the top 40 format at KLIF, and that's a more interesting thing, too. Cliff not only pioneered the top 40 format, but they pioneered beautiful music at cable in San Francisco, Oakland area. The all ads thing in Los Angeles, which wasn't successful, they pioneered several different formats, not just top 40. Yes, sir.
Is Cliff still using all 12 powers now?
I believe they are. Yes, I believe they are.
They definitely still are.
They're not Cliff anymore, but it's 1190. The 1190 frequency is Fox Sports now. Yes, sir.
That site is still out there in Rockwall, and will be featured in the 2004 Tower site.
Cool. Yes, sir.
When did they drop the music?
Well, let's see. They went country first in 81 or so.
I think it was
81. 81, I believe it was 1981. They dropped the music. The top 40 type music and went to country for a while. They hired Don Harris over from WBAP, and at one time had Bill Mack on there and several other people, but country was not successful for them, and they ended up going talk then. They did pretty good for a while doing talk too. And then, were they really? I did not realize that. Yeah, it's gone through several different call letter changes. Interestingly, not too long ago, it was paired back up with 98.7 when Infinity CBS bought them all. They put the 1190 back with 98.7. It was K-Love AM and FM, just like it was when it was Cliff AM and FM. But that's now gone away.
Also, the last time 1190 showed up in New York. I'm serious.
I don't dispute that. Yes, sir. After they sold KLIF, they began selling off all the other radio stations as well. They finally ended up with only one, 98.7 KNUS, which was a top 40 station at the time. 1979, he ended up selling it to San Juan Racing for $4.5 million, I believe. At the time, San Juan Racing was another one of these Fairchild-type places. They had no prior broadcast experience, and they were clearly not successful in their management of the station and sold it at a loss several years later. I think McClendon liked to sell them to people who couldn't up him on it. I don't know that to be true, but that's my personal opinion of it. To give you an example, Fairchild paid $10.5 million for Cliff in 1972. When they finally ended up selling it to Susquehanna years later, they lost $10 million right off the top on the sale, not to mention all the money they lost operating the thing for years and years. Yeah.
Charlie Van Dyke worked for KLIF at one time.
Charlie Van Dyke, a good friend of mine, did indeed work at Cliff and credits it with making his career. He's still the voice of almost every radio station in America and some TV too. Still is heard on KLIF and Channel 11 here in the market. But
WNRC.
And WNRC. That's right. And is has the opening audio to the history of KLIF on my website, but right now it's not working. But he did cut an open for me, and it's on there, just isn't working right now.
What is your website again?
Historyofklif.com. Right in front, Wayne.
One more question. I'm sorry. I've been waiting all night to make this little I don't know how much you might be aware of it, but everybody associates when Bobby Thompson did that whole run of that playoff between the Hall of Fame and the Giants at 51, everybody talks about Russ Hodges' broadcast and such a thing. I personally had a 78 recording of Gordon McClendon's call at a Liberty broadcast.
Right. And he used that in his commercial for the run for Senate, was it, in 1964? Was it the Senate he was running for? He used that audio clip in his commercial saying something like, you may remember me from this, but now I'm doing this.
Well, did you know, too, that in 1994, when the baseball strike was on, around the time that would have been the playoffs in the World Series, WFAN in New York played the whole broadcast of his Liberty Broadcasting System broadcast of that. That game.
Oh, I'd love to get my hands on that.
That's the ninth inning that I had on a record where he hit that home run off Ralph Frank. But the whole game, and in fact, he even mentioned that I didn't know this before that, but Brooklyn was originally called Broken Land, and it came from that, and then somebody decided, well, we'll call it Brooklyn. That was even on the broadcast.
I will say this about Gordon McClendon. Out of the blue, I called him one day in 1983, several years before he passed away, just wondering if I'd get through. I think I stole the phone number out of Ron Chapman's Rolodex. He had his personal phone number. And I called him one afternoon, and he answered the phone. And I just told him, I said, you know, I just want to talk to you about a couple of things. And he was gracious. And for all of the tyrant, screaming, yelling stories I've heard about him, the man could not have been more gracious. And it was very interesting because the conversation I had with him, He talked for over an hour with me on the phone, and at the time ran my bill up to something I couldn't even pay, but I knew it was a one-shot deal, and I just kept talking to him. But he was very open to talk about it, and this is one of the reasons I guess I probably got into this whole thing, too, is because I was so inspired by the fact that he would take the time out of his busy day to talk to me for that long about all of the old stuff. And it was amazing to me because I felt like he probably had a lot to say that nobody had asked. Nobody had asked. And I say in the website, and I say it every time I talk about this, he is the person who should have written the story about KLIF. He is the person that should have done it. He did not, and he no longer will ever be able to, of course, because he died in 1986. But he is the person that could have told the story better than anybody, that's for sure. That's all the time I have. Thank you very much.
I am delighted to introduce one of our long-term members, and he is here from Pennsylvania and remembers some things that perhaps many of you didn't live through. Ben Dangerfield. Ben, when did you become a member?
1958.
A round of applause for our speaker, Ben Dangerfield.
Well, it's nice to be here. Back at my age, it's nice to be anywhere. That was a quote from a very famous radio comedian, George Burns.
Yeah.
And one of my favorites was George Burns, along with Jack Benny. You remember the famous Jack Benny skit where the hold-on man says, "Your money or your life?" And there's a big, long pause. I said, "Your money or your life?" "Well, I'm thinking." That was Mr. Benny. Mr. Benny's Rochester is Mr. Benny's Bell. Anyway, the thing that started this, the idea of World War II DXing, in May, the memorial to the World War II vets was opened up in Washington. And I did go down there with the group from our county. And somebody in our list, our ANDX list, posted an article about it saying how nice it was and how much they respected the veterans. And I came back and put a post out saying, yes, I was there. I'm a veteran of World War II. And in order to keep this thing in line with the DXing, I said, and I DXed during World War II. So this brought some response from some of the members who said, well, we'd like to hear what you say about Dave, what you can say about Dave. So I said, oh, I can do that. But anyway, it developed, and here I am. Well, my DXing World War II, there's a lot to cover, but maybe it started on December 7th, 1941. I was a student at Grove City College, Grove City, Pennsylvania. And anybody might know that that's the location of WSAJ, two towers on top of the science building with the wires in between. And I think they're still, according to Jerry Starr, they're still operating, except they're off right now because of summer vacation. So this radio station was only a few hundred feet from my dormitory. December the 7th, they were off the air. And I was sitting in the dormitory, wasting my time as usual, reading the Sunday paper, listening to the radio, when the bulletin came on, Pearl Harbor has been attacked. And they didn't say right away that it was the Japs that did it, but we knew who was going doing it. So then we had to be hustled off to chapel across the way, because this was a Presbyterian college and you had to go to chapel on Sunday. And WSHA would come on and broadcast that service later. So we couldn't wait to get back after chapel to get to our radios to find out what was going on in the world, Pearl Harbor attack and so forth. So, to make a long story short, DXing in 1941 was quite different than DXing in 2004. There were about less than 1,000 AM radio stations on the air in the United States and Canada together. The FM was just a novelty, and the television was still experimental, so AM radio had really no competition. I was DXing from my room with a 6-tube Philco, and I just had a ground wire plugged to the radiator, but I was able to pick up stations like KSL, KLA, KFI, KNX, and the old KPO without any trouble with this ground wire in the room. And what we could listen to up there at college, we got our NBC programs from WTAM Cleveland or WCAE Pittsburgh. We got our CBS programs from WJAS Pittsburgh or maybe WJR Detroit. And or WKBN Youngstown. And if we wanted to get local programs, music and popular records of the day, we listened to WPIC Sharon or WKST Newcastle, or maybe the new that just came on the air, WISR Butler. So we could also get a great daytime signal from CBL. It was a fairly new station at the time. Now, I should mention that just a couple months prior to the, I have in my hands here a copy of Radex magazine, which is from December 1938. But I made notations on where the stations moved to in August 1941. In August 1941, you probably know there was a large relocation of all the radio stations, almost all the radio stations on the band. The stations. This might be a little hard to do. The stations below 720 remained put. 730 became a Canadian Mexican frequency, and 740. Moved to 750, 750 to 760, 760 to 770, and on up to 780 going to 790, and then they created a new frequency, 800, and, which was for Canadian Mexican stations, and they moved famous CKLW from 1030 to 800 at that time. And then from 800 stations moved to 820. That would have been the Dallas stations, Fort Worth, Dallas. And then from up through 870, they moved two frequencies up to 890. 880 moved up three frequencies to 910, and the stations above that 890, 900, 910, 920, 930, 940, 950, 960 all moved up three. 970 went up to 990. 980 went to 1020. I'm going four up now at this point. 990, which was WBZ, went up to 1030. 1000, WHO and so forth, went up to 1040. And 1010 went up to 1050. 1020, KYW, went up to 1060 and 1030, which was, it sort of got split up and set all over the place. CFCN went to 1010, and as I said, CKLW moved to 800. 1040, which was KRLD and WTIC, moved to 1080. And 1070, 1050, which was KNX, moved to 1070. Then they set up a new station, CBA, came on about that time. 1060 went to 1090, that was WBAL. And 1070 to 1100, and 1080 to 1110, and 90 to 1120. You can see how this was very confusing to radio listeners, but it was a great joy to DXers, having this fun listening to these new frequencies. 1100 to 1130, and 1110 to 1140, 1120 to 1150, 1130 to 1160, 1140 to 1170, 1150 to 1180, that's when. Then 1160, they did some shuffling. They moved WOWO up to 1190, and they moved WWVA to 1170. And those two stations have been sharing time at that point, didn't have to share time anymore. 1170 WCAU Philly went to 1210, and then went up three frequencies all the way up there for quite a ways. We get to 1460, which was WJSV, Washington time, KSTP, went to 1500. Mm-hmm. And the stations in 1500, which was a graveyard channel, went back to 1490. So in Pittsburgh, the WWSW, which was had an all-night program, continued to call it to 1500 Club, even though they went to 1490. And 1470, we're getting up to the end here now, went up to 1510, that was WLAC and so forth, and 1480, which was WKBW, went to 1520, and 1490 went to 1530. Then beyond that, there wasn't very much, except that they set up in 1530 WBRY Waterbury, KITE Kansas City, which had changed calls since then, I think. And 1550 was WQXR and KPMC in Bakersfield. Of course, the other channels up in there, 1600, 1560, so they were all Cuban channels at the time. Okay, that was the big change. The DXing was, I said it was a lot different. DXers in the East Coast were picking up New Zealand and Australia and occasionally Japan without any trouble in the wee hours in the morning, because there wasn't anything broadcasting between 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock in the morning. They all signed up. Let's sign up at local time. So if you tuned between 3 and 6 in the morning, you had an absolutely clear frequency, except for maybe a dozen stations that were doing all night, maybe more than a dozen. I know WNEW was an all-nighter at the time, and WIP, Philadelphia, and a few others. And the WEXL, Rawdell. Okay, they DX has got all these stations, and that's why you hear so many loggings of Australia and New Zealand by DXers all over the country in those years, because you could, if you had 365 days a year to tune for these stations, and you had open, clear frequencies all the time for ion links, all but a handful, you're bound to hear these stations when conditions are good. In fact, there was more TPs heard in the East than TAs in those days. I was living in Pittsburgh at the time. I had no luck with the TAs at the time. I always wanted to hear TAs. That was my big hope. So I got my chance. 1943, I got drafted. And after going through, and then they put me, you never know where they put me, they put me in the medics. I didn't ask for it, but they put me in the medics. I went through basic training in Camp Pickett, Virginia, and went to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, where I suffered in the sun and everything. And then we, eventually in October, we went overseas. And we landed in England, October 43, in Liverpool. And we headed for Malvern in the Midlands, and we got in our new huts. And the first thing I discovered was every hut had a radio in it. Boy, I put my barracks bag down in the bed, and I ran for the radio. Turned around, I could hear a TA. We didn't call them TAs then, but. And I discovered right away that the British stations, the English stations, all had combined into frequencies. There was three, what they call home service frequencies, and two general forces frequencies. They put a bunch of stations on each one of these in order to fool the German airplanes, so they couldn't zero in on the cities. Actually, it's about what they have now over there. You're still getting synchronized radio stations. Am I coming through all right?
Okay. Yeah.
That was our big thrill for me to hear these British stations firsthand, and pretty soon I tuned the dial and I found French stations, German, and Italian, Spanish, began to hear these German propaganda stations broadcasting. This was interesting because I'd heard about Lord Haha, and he used to broadcast from somewhere in Germany over a station in Calais, France, and right across the channel, and he would go in on the British people and give them a hard time telling how bad things were. And then they set up a lady, we say a woman, by the name of Axis Sally. And she became a propaganda speaker for talking to the American troops. We had, this time, there must have been a million or so American troops, close to a million, in England and North Ireland and Scotland. So Axis Sally would come on from the radio station in somewhere in Calais, and she would play Glenn Miller and Bing Crosby records and coo sweetly, and then she would tell the boys what their wives and girlfriends were up to back home and who they were going out with and all this stuff, and then she would say, "You guys don't really want to come over here, do you?" And we just laughed at her. It was funny. So then the Americans had their own broadcasting system over there, the AFN, Armed Forces Network, and which at the time consisted of a lot of low-powered stations, most of them crowded into the upper end of the band, around 1480, 90 kilocycles, and they had them scattered all over London and places, Bristol and so forth, and you could always tell an AFN station because there was a HET on there. They weren't always on frequency. And you could always hear a hum. And these stations would broadcast, they would relay the programs from America via short wave, and they would play records, and they would give us information about how to avoid VD and so forth. You know, all this good stuff we needed to know when we went out of town. And then the thing that I enjoyed listening to them, except there was one guy I didn't like. They broadcast a hit parade from the United States, and on the hit parade was a young singer named Frank Sinatra. And Frank Sinatra would come on the hit parade, and he would start to sing, and the teeny boppers back home would start to screech and yell and rock. And, you know, this didn't go over well with us over there. Here we are over there. We're not knowing what's going to happen next. We're going to go bust a joke. Something's going to happen. And he's back there with these girls yelling after him. So we formed a sort of a biased idea of Frank Sinatra at that point. So the Armed Forces Network was eventually was going to follow the American troops all over Europe. Now, I didn't do any DXing over there in a sense of trying to get stations back home because I didn't know how to do it, really, and I really didn't have time to do it. And when you were working all day, drilling all day or something like that, you don't want to get up in the middle of the night and turn on the radio. So we didn't do anything like that.
At this time, please turn over your tape to side two.